This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, March 4th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a preview of Mardi Gras in Fayetteville. And UA bands prepare for a performance next week.
But first, the Birthright Citizenship Act of 2011 seeks to end the automatic naturalization process for infants born to parents who are not legal U.S. citizens. Supporters of the bill believe many undocumented women enter the U.S. specifically to give birth to improve their chances of gaining citizenship. 4 million children were born to undocumented parents in 2008 at last count. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich attempts to profile birth rates in Arkansas and speaks with immigrant rights advocates who oppose the measure.
The Birthright Citizenship Act of 2011 seeks to amend the Immigration and Nationality Act to clarify classes of individuals born in the United States who automatically become citizens of the United States at birth. The bill was introduced in the U.S. House in early January by Iowa Representative Steve King, an ultra-conservative Republican, referred to the House Judiciary Committee, then on to Subcommittee on Immigration Policy and Enforcement. The bill has 66 co-sponsors, including Arkansas Representative Rick Crawford, Tim Griffin, and Steve Womack. Democrat Mike Ross does not support it. Steve Womack went on record referring to undocumented infants born in the U.S. as anchor babies, and that the illegal immigration phenomenon is a festering problem. As a resident of Rogers, he's witnessed firsthand a surge of immigrants in his district over the past 25 years. Nationwide, 11 million unauthorized immigrants reside in the United States as of October 2010. And according to our new census figures, the Hispanic population in Arkansas has doubled since 2000 to 186,000, 6.4% of the state's population. As many as 60,000 may be undocumented. We'll never know. Of course, the state's immigration epicenter for a Marshallese diaspora as well is Springdale, Arkansas. Many pregnant alien mothers end up here at Community Clinic, a federally qualified health clinic which provides critical prenatal care for low-income families. Kathy Grisham is the clinic's longtime executive director. She says birthright citizenship laws, as they stand, save taxpayers a tremendous amount of money.
Undocumented women can qualify for Medicaid in the same way anyone else qualifies for Medicaid because the services go to the unborn child. It's an SCHIP program that the state had to approve, and they did that in maybe July of 2005. When the baby's born, they're a U.S. citizen. So it's a perfect way to take care of a baby. Keep a baby from being a million-dollar baby, because for every dollar invested in prenatal care, you save at least $7 in afterbirth care. So you keep babies from becoming million-dollar babies because of a lack of prenatal care. And it's our community that absorbs that cost, because we would take care of those babies at our hospitals and there would be no reimbursement for that care.
In 2010, Community Clinic, which operates three medical sites in northwest Arkansas, had 75,000 patient visits from low-income residents with no insurance, up from 18,000 in 2005. But staff don't track citizenship status. Last year, the clinic provided prenatal care to 1,481 patients over nearly 5,400 visits. 44% were Hispanic and 11% Marshallese. Community Clinic staff refer expectant mothers to the nearest hospital, primarily Northwest Health System and its partner facility, Willow Creek Women's Hospital. In 2005, it recorded 399 Hispanic newborns. By 2010, that number increased to 692. Washington Regional Medical Center provides birthing facilities to immigrant moms. In 2005, 354 Hispanic babies were born there. 10 years later, only 86 were recorded. Hospital officials are unable to interpret the significant decrease. Neither hospital tracks documentation status. Hospitals who take charity cases often have to write off the cost of that care, and critics who seek to repeal birthright citizenship cite that burden to both hospitals and taxpayers. Giving birth to a U.S. citizen does provide a path to naturalization. Undocumented parents can petition for legal residency when their child reaches 21 years of age. but referring to such children as anchor babies upsets Community Clinic Executive Director Kathy Grisham.
What we see at the Community Clinic are people have come to this country because of jobs that are here. They came here for the same reason my ancestors came here, however many generations ago that was, for a better opportunity.
The Pew Hispanic Center corroborates this. It found that only 9% of undocumented Hispanic women who've given birth have recently crossed into the United States. Tara Manthe, spokesperson for Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families in Little Rock, she says denying babies an American birthright poses a certain danger.
You know, we are concerned that if a fundamental right like having citizenship at birth is taken away, you would have a very large population of children who are children without a nation, who would not have somewhere to, they would kind of live on the outside margins of our society and would be at risk of exploitation or deportation to a country that they have never known. We would be concerned about them not being able to get an education, to get access to preventative services, and becoming ill and not educated, and then not being able to help our economy and country move ahead when they're adults.
Unauthorized immigration has decreased due to a contracted U.S. economy. But data show in Oklahoma and likely in neighboring Arkansas, the undocumented population is on the rise. Under an amended birthright citizenship law, if one parent is legal, their infant will be as well. Nationwide, the number of children born to at least one unauthorized immigrant parent in 2009 was 350,000, 8% of all U.S. newborns. It's been a month since the birthright citizenship bill has been considered. What with more pressing congressional issues like the federal budget and deficit reductions. But once immigration issues resurface, Americans will be given an opportunity to understand the law as stated in the 14th Amendment. Ratified in 1868, it states all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. But that middle clause, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, has divided both politicians and constitutional scholars. So even if the measure passes, any birthright citizenship repeal, even if enacted at the state level, will likely end up in the courts. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The parents who share the experience of losing a child, may you find comfort in knowing the challenges are real and you are not alone. Rhonda Fincher expresses this sentiment at the beginning of her new book, Goodnight, Kendrick, I Love You, A Mother's Journal Through Grief. Fincher lost her son more than 15 years ago due to a heat stroke he suffered while playing football.
The book was written really before I decided to write a book, because after Kendrick died, my connection to him was writing letters to him. Actually, when he was in the hospital, I started keeping a journal so that when he got out, he would know what had been going on, because he was in a drug-induced coma the whole time. And then after he died and we got home, I just wanted to connect to him somehow. So I started writing letters to him in a journal. And it was about 2 years after he died, and I'd been writing the journals, and I'd read a ton of books on grief. And to me, I couldn't feel the pain. You know, parents had written them. Experts, of course, had written books. And to me, I didn't really care what the experts had written. I really wanted to read something from a parent that showed how hard grief was and that they made it through. And I started thinking, you know, my journal is, it shows the pain that you go through, and it shows you can get through. And this was 2 years after he died, and I really wasn't through much at that point. But I thought at that point, you know, my journals will probably make a good story, a good book. And that's when I decided I needed to put it in a book, and that was 13 years ago.
Fincher says she wanted to share her story because she thought it might be helpful to others. By reading the book, she says the reader can sense pain, heartache, and hope, and see that she made it through the grief, though she admits it wasn't easy. After adding some narrative to her journal entries and having some friends help edit her manuscript, she self-published her book earlier this year.
I wanted to stay true to what was in my journal, and I didn't want my feelings edited away. And, you know, sometimes that can be done if you get a strong editor.
Something she learned after going through the grieving process is parents who have lost a child need something to look forward to. She says they need to replace heartache with something positive and some joy. One of the positive things Fincher has done since the loss of her son is create the Kendrick Fincher Hydration Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting proper hydration and preventing heat illness. Although it took some time, Fincher is happy to have finally published her book.
I'm glad I finished it. I'm glad I did it. You know, I will probably always think, well, maybe I should have done this a little bit differently or that a little bit differently. But I think I kept it true enough to my journal during the grieving process, which is the purpose to help grieving parents. And there's a lot of information out there to help grieving parents. A grieving parent may choose something different that's helpful to them. Just because this was helpful to me doesn't mean it's going to be helpful to everybody. It's just another tool that people can use to help them get through grief. It's also something that can be helpful to better understand your friend that's going through a grieving process, because you can kind of see that, you know, even though they might look like, you know, their child's been gone 5 months forever, you'd think that they should be moving on. Not at all. The 5 to 7 months after a child dies are actually one of the worst periods of time. So it can be helpful for people that have a friend that has lost a child, better understand grief. Employers, there's a lot of information on the challenges I was going through with my work because my child died. And then I had a friend that read it recently, and he said that really, in terms of just overcoming life challenges, I was facing, my sister was also dying at the same time. She was diagnosed with cancer before Kendrick died, and then she died a little over a year after he died. So there were a number of challenges going on in my life, and what my one friend that read it that hasn't lost, you know, anyone close to him, he said, you know, it really gives people an insight into how they can overcome life's challenges in general.
Copies of the book are available at the Foundation office, which is located at 812 West Cypress in Rogers. The book can also be ordered through Amazon.com. A portion of the proceeds will benefit the Kendrick Fincher Hydration Foundation. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Friday Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. As you may have heard, P.J. Hrabowski has retired from radio and moved west. And that means that the new Blues Show, formerly heard Friday nights at 7, no longer exists. What that means is now the evening edition of Ozarks at Large on Friday is on at 7. And we welcome Terry Gross and Fresh Air back to our Friday night lineup at 6 o'clock. So Monday through Friday, it's Fresh Air at 6 and the evening editions of Ozarks at Large at 7. Aldo Leopold is considered the father of wildlife management and of the United States wilderness system. His life and work will be celebrated tomorrow in the event Hobbs Celebrates Leopold, being held at the Hobbs State Park Conservation Area Visitor Center. The event will also include the screening of Greenfire, a documentary based upon the life of Aldo Leopold. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madolkar has this report.
The Hobbs State Park Conservation Area, along with friends of Hobbs, will celebrate the life and work of naturalist Aldo Leopold tomorrow. The celebration of Aldo Leopold Weekend started in Wisconsin in 2004 when Governor James Doyle signed legislation designating the first weekend in March the Aldo Leopold Weekend. The event has now become a part of many March calendars throughout the nation. Tom McClure is the president of Friends of Hobbs, a nonprofit dedicated to promoting the mission of Hobbs State Park. According to him, Leopold was much ahead of his times, even though he was born in 1887 and passed away in 1948.
He was several things, actually. He was, for his professional career, he was a forester, a wildlife manager, a college professor, was an active conservationist with the Wilderness Society. He was a writer, a naturalist, He wrote many articles about wildlife management and forestry, but he really only wrote one book called A Sand County Almanac that was published. He died of a heart attack suddenly while he was helping a neighbor fight a fire in 1948, but he had found out 2 weeks earlier that his book was going to be published.
Leopold was a visionary on conservation fronts. He was originally from Iowa, went to Yale, and was one of the first graduates of the Yale Forestry School. He worked for the United States Forest Service and later became the first wildlife management professor at the University of Wisconsin. He taught at the university from 1933 through 1948.
When you talk about his contributions, I would say his writings over the years were important, but something that really set him apart is his proposal at in the last part of Sand County Almanac. He talks about a land ethic, and he mentions that we have ethics in other parts of our lives, but we are lacking a land ethic of what is a...
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is W. Dale Warren from the University of Arkansas. He's the conductor of the University of Arkansas Bands. Two big shows, Monday and Tuesday night.
Yes, Kyle. It's the 7th and 8th. We've got Monday evening, we have the Campus Band and Symphonic Band. Tuesday evening, we have the Concert Band and Wind Symphony. It's going to be our usual blowout.
Now, you and I have talked about this before, but people should realize that some of the most contemporary music in the world are in these concerts. Now, you'll see names Sousa and Ralph Vaughan Williams, but there are folks in here born in the late 60s and early 70s as composers, people who are educators now. And we'll hear music written within the last 2 or 3 years.
Oh, absolutely true. Now, I don't know that we have anything quite that new on the program. We have a lot of 2003, 2004 types. But you got to remember, the wind band is the newest ensemble in the country. I mean, we're only 100 years old. Our first masterwork was a whole suite in E-flat in 1909. So that makes us 102 officially, I guess. But we didn't have any what we considered masterworks prior to that time. And, of course, after World War II, the Pullet School band movement really started to take off in America. And now, you know, there's no way that you'd think of a high school without a high school band, because, you know, football and athletic support, as well as the artistic functions. So it's we're kind of the exciting new thing for composers to write for.
And there's a lot of it being written.
Oh, my goodness gracious. We're living the most exciting time for composition in wind band. I mean, I was asking my conducting students yesterday about, name me 10 world-class pieces that have been written for orchestra in the last 50 years. The choir, piano, chamber music. I mean, you get it. And, composers write for bands because bands will take a chance on new music and on new composers. And it doesn't have to be 100, 200 years old for somebody to take a chance on it, knowing it's going to work. And I think that's a pretty special time for us, and we need to capitalize on that.
Monday night's concert begins with Fanfare and Flourishes. What else would you want to start a concert with?
Well, sure. I mean, if you're going to start the semester out with something big, let's just go full class, you know. And so Jim Kernow is one of the best brass band writers in the world, and this piece was originally a brass band piece, and it translates spectacularly well for the wind band. And it's going to kick the concert off with quite the bang.
Now, I was talking about contemporary music. Next is Whither I Must Wander, Ralph Vaughan Williams. That's about 100 and some years old.
Right. I mean, 1902. Mm-hmm. And so it's just gorgeous. It's a choral piece that he set for winds. I don't know. I think it works better for the winds. I mean, we do miss the text, of course, but if you know the poem and you know the story behind it, it makes perfect sense. But the colors and the timbres in it are just spectacular.
And you move on with Awakening Hills. That's by a living composer.
Richard was born in 1957, actually, and he's we tease each other because he's slightly older than me, so I always get to have the old man conversation with him. But he's one of the hot commodities in the wind band world right now. He's getting so many commissions, you just can't keep up with them all. And this is a really exciting overture, and we've put it in the middle of the program to kind of give us that, ABA, ABABA kind of a function within this concert. But I think if there's anything the audience will leave the building tapping their toe to and humming it on the way home, it'll be this.
The first portion ends with Twilight in the Wilderness, and then Bayou Breakdown by a gentleman who I think teaches at Northern Kentucky University.
Right, Brant Carey. Brant and I have known each other since his birth. His dad was a great high school band director in Kentucky and has written several pieces actually for me on commission. And Brant is even a better composer than his dad. And Brant, terrific trumpet player, great conductor. I mean, he does it all. He came out of the womb really good. You know, he's just one of those guys that's stinking talented, stinking smart, and you just go, why can't I be as good as you, you know? But by your breakdown, he went to LSU for his doctorate and fell in love with that whole Cajun French music culture. And, of course, who doesn't love the food? But this whole thing is really about being out on the bayou and just playing some music out Saturday night and letting the dance start. It's just fun.
Monday night's concert after Bayou Breakdown, it's the intermission, then the symphonic band program. More Ray Vaughan Williams?
Right. Toccata Marziale is one of his most well-known work for winds, and it is a masterpiece in our genre. And it's totally different from the piece you'll hear the campus band play. I mean, it's exciting. It's that British pomp and circumstance. It's thickly scored, tons of counterpoint. You have to really have your ears open all the time and be on high alert to catch everything as it goes by. It's really quite the contrapuntal masterpiece.
And Holst on the
program?
They
were best friends. Why not? Just do it back to back. I mean, they went to school together and they were, you know, kind of inseparable buds, and they influenced each other so much. And of course, like I said already, the First Suite in E flat is the band world's first major masterpiece. And there's just not anything better.
And then you back it up with Crump.
Well, that's new. Scott McAllister is down at Baylor and just a wonderful composer. And this is a really unique piece. And I actually haven't heard it much because the symphonic band rehearses the same time my group does. So I haven't got to hear it in progress, but I've seen the score and it's really interesting. I think you're going to find some sounds in Crump that you have not heard out of wind band before.
And it's inspired by the dance moves that are involved in crumping.
Absolutely right.
Which is a sort of frenetic.
Exactly.
Popping sort of.
It's very, I would call it robotic.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of jerky. It's not parkour, you know, where it's smoother and more lyrical,
right.
But it would be very much like you're doing the robot dance, you know.
And that's all Monday night.
That's right. That's a full-blown evening. Absolutely true.
Walton Arts Center, Baum Walker.
7:30. Very good. It'll be the best money that you could spend.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kyle.
W. Dale Warren is Director of Concert Bands and Associate Professor of Music in the University of Arkansas Department of Music. We also talked about the concert at Walton Arts Center that takes place Tuesday night. And you can hear details about that performance Sunday morning on Weekend Ozarks at Large. That's Sunday morning at 9 on KUAF.